This is Science Friday. I'm Flora Lichtman. Ira Flatow is away. A bit later in the hour, we'll be talking about how women are breaking into the male-dominated world of blockchain and cryptocurrencies. But first, this week, astrophysicist Stephen Hawking passed away. Joining me now to talk about that and other science news from the week is Amy Nordrum, news editor at IEEE Spectrum. She's here in our New York studios. Welcome back, Amy.
Hi, Flora.
Hey, so I feel like most of us know Stephen Hawking's name, but what was he famous for scientifically?
Yeah, Stephen Hawking is a renowned physicist, and he's perhaps best known for his contributions to our understanding of black holes. So black holes are these swirls of mass and energy with a big gravitational pull so strong that not even light can escape them. And Hawking's contribution was primarily to show that these black holes actually do emit some things. So they can emit radiation, they can actually emit particles. And this is now termed Hawking radiation among physicists. And it's led to a lot of new questions around black holes and new paths for people to continue to explore in physics.
I think I remember I was reading the obituaries this week, and people called his paper on exploding black holes like the most beautiful physics paper ever written.
That's right. I actually tried to read it. It was published in Nature, and I couldn't understand it. But it's full of equations, and obviously physicists are still thinking a lot about it and continuing to work on the theories that he's put forward.
Okay, so if I want to read some Hawking, where should I start?
Yeah, Hawking is also a beloved popularizer of science. So in the 1980s, he published a book called A Brief History of Time, and that book has sold more than 10 million copies since its publication. So a lot of people, you know, look at that book. He attempts to take on a very difficult role for an author, which is explain the history of the universe. But, you know, a lot of people have found it useful and very accessible for his interpretation of it.
So Dr. Hawking was on Science Friday. We have a clip from a recording of Dr. Hawking made for Science Friday back in 2013. He suffered from a neurodegenerative illness, and he spoke using a speech synthesizer. And here's what he said when we asked him about the limits of science.
I believe there are no questions that science can't answer about the physical universe. Although we don't yet have a full understanding of the laws of nature, I think we will eventually find a complete unified theory. Some people would claim that things like love, joy, and beauty belong to a different category from science and can't be described in scientific terms, but I think they can all be explained by the theory of evolution.
So moving.
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of his greatness comes from his ability to kind of combine and blend different areas of science and different theories. So his work on black holes was combining, you know, Einstein's theory of relativity and what it says about how massive objects produce a gravitational force with quantum mechanics, which is really concerned with the tiniest particles that we know of. And so his ability to kind of bridge these fields and like you said, try to come up with a theory of everything is a really powerful concept. And he wasn't able to ever formalize that himself, but obviously work will continue on that, and it's a really grand idea to think about.
He will certainly be missed. In other news this week, you have a story, this is really tantalizing, I think, about rogue satellites.
That's right. You know, there's a lot of action in the private space world right now. There's all kinds of startups that are throwing up satellites for lots of different reasons and purposes. New business models being formed around these lower cost, cheaper satellite launches. And there's one company in particular that one of our contributors, Mark Harris, took a look at. So this company is called Swarm Technologies, and they're based in Silicon Valley. And they had this innovative kind of experimental satellite concept. So these satellites that they proposed to launch were about a fourth the size of the smallest satellites that are going up into orbit today.
So how big are they?
They're about the size of a hardback book, you could say.
Smaller than a bread box.
Smaller than a CubeSat, which is what the bread box size satellites are that you always hear about. So they're going to launch these tinier satellites up into space, and they're going to use them to form this communications network. So they have this idea that, you know, we're going to need more and more things connected down here on Earth, and companies will pay to track devices that are being attached to trucks and other goods as they move around the world.
Is this like Internet of Things?
Yeah, exactly. So they would be supplying the kind of backhaul, the data transmission capabilities that these tiny little IoT devices would be sending up to space. So Swarm had this, you know, this big idea, and they applied for an FCC license to launch these tiny satellites. And the FCC actually denied their license last year because they were worried the satellites were too small, they'd be tough to track, and they'd be tough for other spacecraft and satellites to detect and stay out of the way of. So it appears now, based on Mark Harris's work, that the company has gone forward and launched these satellites anyway. So Swarm appears to have launched the satellites in January on a rocket that was launched by the Indian Space Agency. And the FCC is not too happy about this, as you can imagine.
So what is the recourse for the FCC, though? Like, they're there, right?
Well, they're up there. Yeah, they're in orbit, so far as we can tell, on about the same path that Swarm had originally proposed sending them on. And the FCC's response has been to issue a very strongly worded letter that Swarm had applied for another license to launch some more rockets or some more satellites on a rocket this April. And so now the FCC is taking a look again at that application they'd already granted and possibly going to revoke it.
Does the FCC, I can't understand the jurisdiction, though, because the FCC, they don't, obviously don't regulate what goes on into an Indian rocket, for example, right?
Yeah, I mean, the FCC has authority over these U.S. startups, and it was an unauthorized launch. They were concerned about the safety of it. And there's at least three federal agencies, the FCC, the FAA, and then the NOAA that have some jurisdiction over space launches and making sure that space is safe for everyone, that these satellite launches go well. But it's tricky because obviously there are more and more opportunities to launch all around the world for these startups to take advantage of. And Swarm may have found a loophole in this process.
This feels like a classic ask forgiveness, not permission.
That may be what's happening here. And Swarm has not said anything about it. And the FCC so far hasn't commented beyond, you know, what we are able to read in their letter. So we're going to be watching this story and seeing how it plays out.
Oh, interesting. Okay, closer to home, there was a story this week about a snow-melting blanket. Tell me more.
Yeah, this researcher at Virginia Tech, he was driving around campus one day, and it had snowed recently, and he was late to a meeting. And so he was kind of panicking, trying to find a parking spot. And the parking lot he was in, he realizes like a third of the spaces were full of snow and these massive snow banks that the plows had created when they had tried to clear the parking lot.
I'm familiar with this as a New Yorker.
Yeah, this is a chronic problem a lot of people in northern climates can relate to. So he started thinking about it and he realized this is like a problem that we create for ourselves because we're the ones that pile up snow into these big banks, and snow is highly reflective, and so it's tough for the middle of those snow banks to melt away, and then they last for a really long time. This is bothering him so much that he's come up with this solution to it, like many great scientists do. And he's conceived of this thermal blanket. And he says if we had a thermal blanket that we could throw over these snowbanks and help the snow melt faster, that would be super useful. And so far, he's made it as far as to do a lab experiment in which he's just spray-painted aluminum foil black and then put that over some snow that he made with, like, a snow cone maker. But this is how things start, right? So the snow blanket or the thermal blanket, which is really a piece of aluminum foil, he tested it in the lab, and it effectively melted snow three times faster than if the snow had just been left on its own.
So you put this blanket over a snowbank. It's black, so it absorbs heat from the sun.
Exactly.
And then it transfers it to the snow and melts it.
That's why it's important that it's metal, too, so it can conduct the heat from the outer surface to the inner surface. And so, that's his idea, and he's hoping, you know, that it worked in the lab three times faster, so he's thinking that maybe this could be a commercial product someday.
Or a DIY project.
Yeah, I mean, you could try this at home, absolutely. It's something that, you know, is low material cost, so low investment. And he thinks there could be some environmental and cost savings here. I mean, cities pay tons of money to have snow removal every year and use a lot of salt and chemicals to get rid of it, too. So this could be a better way.
All right, next up, I want you to listen to this. Amy, what are we listening to?
Those are ravens, and they are doing what's known as food calls. So there's This is a call that they would do when, you know, they're around some food that they can't get to, basically. They want to get to the food, but there's a problem. The problem could be a predator, or it could be that there's another territorial pair of ravens that are kind of defending it.
It's like a hangry call.
Yeah, you could definitely characterize it as a hangry call. And so the ravens are basically asking for help. I mean, they're putting these calls out, trying to get reinforcements, trying to get other ravens to join them. And some new research out this week showed that the raven call, it contains more than just information. It's not just communicating that, you know, they see food and they want to go get it. It also contains particular characteristics to each individual. So it's possible to distinguish the age of the raven and the sex of the raven based on these calls. And that's not unlike humans, where, you know, you can maybe guess whether someone's young or old based on the frequency and amplitude of their voice. So now we know that the same thing happens in ravens.
That makes sense. Okay, we have time for one more, I think. And this is like the most fun application of graphene that I've heard about. So remind us what graphene is.
Yeah, graphene is a material that has an almost comical reputation for being applied for all kinds of solutions and ideas within electronics mainly, but also other fields. It's a single layer of carbon atoms, and it's very strong. It's highly conductive. It has a lot of cool properties. It's the thinnest material we've ever been able to find. And this is a very peculiar idea for how to use graphene. There's some researchers at Northwestern University who have proposed a way to dye hair with graphene, which I'd never heard of before.
And so it wraps around the individual hairs? Do I have that right?
Yeah, it's kind of cool when you think about it, because a lot of hair dyes, they actually pull up the cuticle or outer covering of the hair strand, and there's a chemical combination that occurs within the hair to dye the strand. And this one more just like wraps around the outside, so it's more of like a coating. And they did test it. I guess the minimum number of washes you need to get a hair dye to be considered permanent is 30, and this lasts longer than 30 washes. So it dyes your hair deep black, by the way, and they're also able to get shades of brown too.
But that's it.
Yeah, I mean, you wouldn't go blonde with graphene, I don't think.
I have this vision of the lab of just like tons of wigs or like mice with interesting new hair colors.
Yeah, I mean, they did some cool like frizz tests too in terms of static electricity, because graphene is so conductive. The idea is that actually putting this hair dye in your hair can remove static electricity, because it helps it get rid of, you know, built up charges more easily. So
it's a frizz ease as well.
Yeah, defrizz.
Can I buy it?
Not yet. It's definitely still in the lab stages. Maybe someday.
Thank you, Amy.
Thanks.
Amy Nordstrom is the news editor at IEEE Spectrum. When we come back, why we need more women joining the blockchain movement. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Flora Lichtman. At South by Southwest, a tech conference in Austin this week, one word was on everybody's lips: blockchain. It's the technology that makes every transaction made with Bitcoin or any digital currency possible. And when Bitcoin's value surged last year, it turned average Joes into millionaires. And yes, specifically Joes, because most surveys show that roughly 95% of blockchain enthusiasts and crypto investors are men. Joining me now to talk about that and why it matters are my guests. Nellie Bowles is a reporter covering tech and internet culture for the New York Times. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you so much for having me.
Carrie Flynn reports on the business of technology for Mashable. Welcome to SciFry.
Hi, thank you.
Veronica Reynolds, co-founder of the UCLA Blockchain Lab. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me.
And are you a woman working in blockchain? Please give us a call. We want to hear from you. Our number is 844-724-8255. That's 844-SCI-TALK, or tweet us at SciFry. Okay. Nellie, I know this is risky because we're on live radio
now. I'm nervous already.
Don't be. Blockchain is notoriously difficult to explain and understand, I think. I don't think I'm a... So do you have a
People always have like a new metaphor for how to explain blockchain. They'll be like, okay, it's like an ATM, and then there's a camel, and blockchain is a publicly verifiable digital ledger, is kind of a quick jargony way to explain it. It's a platform. It will be used for many different things. How the blockchain is used in our lives and what it means is really yet to be seen. And that's what's so exciting about right now and about covering it right now.
Veronica, you work in blockchain. Does that sound right to you? Is there anything you'd add?
No, I think that's a pretty good description. I always describe it as a decentralized ledger where people from around the world can contribute their transactions in a public, transparent way.
So it's the ledger exists in multiple places, so that provides some added security. Do I have that right?
Yeah, I mean, you can say it exists in multiple places. It technically does, right? So computers serve as nodes, and so the ledger is actually sitting on these computers around the world. But in another sense, it's existing kind of everywhere and nowhere at the same time.
Great. Gary, you were at South by Southwest this week. So blockchain isn't just about cryptocurrencies, right? Like, what are the other ways that people are using it?
Yeah, the cryptocurrency part is definitely a really loud and really understandable use case of it. But I spoke with a lot of people there who see it being far greater, just like the internet isn't just for reading about news stories. I think one that's been most fascinating is the benefit for food supply. So, for instance, a restaurant being able to really understand whether or not the food that they get from a farm is actually directly from the farm, being able to track where your food is being sourced and where it's coming from. And then because it's publicly available, it's not just the supplier and the distributor, but also people like you and me being able to verify that it's true.
Cool. So, Nelly, you wrote an article about blockchain bros. Did you coin the term?
The people I interviewed coined the term, but I did, yes.
So walk me through the type specimen of a blockchain bro.
The type specimen. So I'm based in San Francisco, and I've been covering the blockchain boom that we've seen over the last year and the sort of culture of it. And one aspect of the culture of it is that there are major gender problems. It is a predominantly male space, and a lot of women were involved early on and have felt like they are being pushed out now as the sort of price of cryptocurrencies has gone up and there's been a frenzy and the quote-unquote blockchain bros have come into the space. The blockchain bro being someone who maybe doesn't have extreme technical knowledge but maybe bought Bitcoin or Ether early on, was on Reddit, was on 4chan, was sort of active and involved in this community, but is sort of like in it for cash.
Where was the bro born? The blockchain bro? Let me be specific. Where was the blockchain bro born? I mean, are these like finance people or?
It's a mix. I mean, it's a community. It's an industry that's exploding. There's not one type of person. You will find really serious, really philosophical nerds who just want to see a revolution take over. And you will find people who are in it for get-rich-quick schemes, who want to run scams. And you will find all kinds of people in the space. The gender situation is very problematic, though. And that is something that you hear time and again. And problematic in serious ways. I mean, conferences with 85-to-1 speaker skews. You know, I mean, just astonishing numbers. And you go to these meetups, and often you don't run into a lot of women.
Veronica, is that your experience?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. So I actually worked in music and tech prior to this. So I was a little bit used to kind of the gender disparity in both of those industries. And I started going to a lot of events in the middle of last year. And at the first big conference I went to, I kind of came in after lunch and I looked around and I felt uncomfortable. And I asked myself, gosh, why are you feeling uncomfortable right now? And then it dawned on me, it's because I don't see myself mirrored. Like I looked around and it was a sea of men. And so what I started doing at that conference, and basically every event I've been to since, is just walking up to the other women, kind of commenting on the gender disparity and saying, can we connect? Can we do something? And so what's happened as a result of that is I've joined a bunch of Slack, Telegram, Facebook, and WhatsApp channels that are just groups of women who are connected around blockchain. And it spans women from finance, engineers, policy, et cetera, all just kind of gathering. And you've seen this real, I think, this year, especially in the early part of 2018, just a lot of events emerging that are focused, and most of them are women-driven, around women in blockchain and kind of highlighting not the fact that we're women, the fact that we're doing things in the space.
What are the stakes of women being left out of this?
The stakes are huge. I mean, I have covered the last startup boom and now this, which is really looking to be like a like another sort of industry-wide boom in the same way that the internet was and the mobile web was. The early winners in these spaces set the tone and start a cascade of effects that lasts for the entire generation of the space. They become the investors. They become the social community leaders. It matters a lot. And so kind of, I think a lot of people are feeling like they don't want history to repeat itself. They don't want the same thing that we saw with the last startup boom to happen again.
Yeah, and I think there's a big idea because we're not seeing many women in the space right now. Sure, like we just spoke about, there are women groups, and that's awesome. But if women aren't put in the spotlight, that's where you have an issue of future people, people who are not in the community already, but are maybe thinking about it, feeling like we talked about, not welcomed. And that's exactly what we experienced in the tech. And then when finally women start to join, then they feel like they need to leave and they don't stay on. And I would be scared of a future there.
Tell me about Portopia.
Portopia. So that's a little bit, it's related to the sort of gender stuff, but it's kind of a separate story. Portopia is a utopian effort that's happening in Puerto Rico right now, led by a group of young men who made a lot of money on blockchain. Actually, some young, some sort of middle-aged who had some successes and some failures in Silicon Valley. They all made a lot of money on Bitcoin, Ethereum, and now they're trying to build a city in Puerto Rico.
A
physical city. Oh, yeah. I mean, in part just to get around the taxes. And I mean, taxes in the U.S. because Puerto Rico is an advantageous system. And so to me, what's so interesting about that is that there is a big social vision here with cryptocurrency, and that's what makes it so fun to cover. And that's what makes it not just like covering banking or something. There really are these true believers. And again, then if you think about a utopian vision, that's why sort of remembering gender equality, remembering like also racial diversity in this space is so important.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like that's the utopian vision is completely at odds with the makeup of the community.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I would just say that the women I've spoken to in this space, whether it was at South By or this morning, I was on the phone with Jenny Kuta, who is a Wall Street veteran, and she's now in this space. And she, like you said, like she envisions this as democratizing the internet and currency, and it's supposed to empower people. And that's exactly why she's like, women, get involved. This is our chance. So we need more people like that saying that and actually doing something about it.
That it could like disrupt the financial systems we have in place. And, you know, if you hear the kind of like end society, the ideal end society, it's an amazingly egalitarian space with, you know, where banks have lost all power and all of us are sort of running the economy.
Veronica, what are the barriers to women entering this field?
Well, I think a lot of them are systemic. So kind of listening to, you know, the conversation, women need to get involved. They do, but I also think, and I think the technology, to everyone's point, has the capability of democratizing the world or making it equal for all. But not alone, right? The technology itself is morally agnostic, and I think we need to keep having these conversations. I think the Me Too movement was, you know, I think very powerful. I think for me, the big takeaway from that is women should be heard. Women should be listened to. And I think that's why we're seeing a lot of women speak out, and especially a lot of women are speaking out in the blockchain industry. And there's women I'm working with here in LA, and we're putting together meetups. There's one happening in a couple weeks with Melrose PR, and there's one on April 11th that we're having at Coral Tree Cafe, and then we're planning a kind of a series to help new women who are looking to enter the space come in. And I think that that's one way of many to kind of attack the systemic barriers, at least in the United States, that women have historically faced. And you see this, like there's I won't name who wrote this, but, you know, for example, there was a guy who wrote a blog post, and he was talking about how his firsthand experience is that women just don't want to do the work to be a part of it. So if that's your viewpoint going into it, is not that women are dumb, but they don't want to or they're not interested, and then that's how you treat them. So when you see a woman, you just assume, oh, are you in marketing? And really, she's an engineer. So I think that's kind of what we face.
Let's go to the phones. Christina in Fort Collins, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi. I was just on hold and I lost you, or something happened.
Are you back now? You're on the air.
I am.
Tell us your question.
I am.
Yes.
Okay. I have been interested in the blockchain technology for, running on about five, when it first emerged, and I had a lot of visionary experience around then on how I wanted to structure a business, and sort of almost like a commons type thing where everybody's represented and everybody's works a worker-owned entity, holacracy-governed, using blockchain, even potentially creating currency, and I thought I had a lot of people on board, but the problem was a lot of people didn't really understand what I was talking about. And I ran into people who, there's a different, you're either a cooperator or you're a competitor, and you can't be both. And so it's been really difficult to find the true cooperators in the community and then to have the kind of understanding. So now that it's coming out into the mainstream, I'm super excited because I still want to create the same kind of entity, and yet I don't necessarily have the tools or the time because I'm also working out of my permaculture site and creating all kinds of other things. So I'm wondering about mentoring, and that's my big question, I guess. I need a mentor.
Thanks, Christina. I'm Flora Lichtman, and this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Carrie, I noticed you jumping in. No?
I jump in. Yeah. I guess what's been inspiring to me, like I said, I've spoken to women in the blockchain industry, and the VP of blockchain, which is a real title, VP of blockchain at IBM, is a woman. And that's awesome. And she says that almost her entire team is female driven. And also IBM has a female CEO. So yeah, there are some pretty powerful women in this space. And I mean, I spoke with her at South by Southwest, and I'm sure she would love to speak with you and with other women in the industry. And it's fascinating that, this blockchain isn't just about startups and new businesses, as great as that is. Blockchain is an investment that giant corporations like IBM are betting on. So go reach out to them.
Veronica, any tips for mentoring or how to get in?
Yeah, I would say, look for meetups in your area. I didn't catch the town that she was from, but basically in every major city, there's women in blockchain meetups. And I think, something that I had done was I kind of reached out. I read a blog post by Preeti Kasariddi, and it just really resonated with me, and she was moving to LA. So I just kind of reached out and said hello, and we ended up connecting. So I think if there's someone in particular that kind of resonates with you in the space, I've always found reaching out and just even saying hello can be beneficial.
I think there's something intimidating about it, about blockchain, because it's hard to understand and wrap your mind around, and because it's so new, and so we're still waiting for some of these applications. I'm not saying that it should be, but how much do I actually have to know to get involved in this space?
I think it has been kept somewhat intentionally confusing.
Really?
I actually don't think it's as complicated as we're sort of led to believe.
Really? Tell me more.
I think there are people who benefit from obfuscating how it works, I talked to this fantastic entrepreneur, Ariana Simpson, who, how she phrased it was, and she's in the blockchain space, was sort of women are always waiting till they're experts, or they're waiting till they have a PhD in something, and she's like, but look at these sort of clowns around us, look at these people just jumping in and sort of getting rich quick on the space. So you don't need an enormous amount of expertise because no one has an enormous amount of expertise.
Veronica,
this stuff is
agree?
Brand new.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think the underlying technology is a little complex. I don't think people should be afraid of that. Sometimes I do, and I don't know, maybe it's just my circle. Sometimes women seem to have a little bit more hesitation. And I think to Nelly's point, I think we, and maybe it's a cultural thing, I'm not sure, but I think more often than not, we really want to master the space before we go off and talk about it. And I think there's a wisdom to that. There's an inherent, being risk averse. Yeah. But I also think there's this emphasis where you have to understand all of the tech. And I think like any industry, there's other aspects, for example, tokenomics, that we really need knowledgeable people about. While I do think understanding, what hashing is, for example, is really important, because then you understand the applications a lot better.
What's hashing?
So, Nelly, do you want to explain that?
Get out of here.
I'm going to butcher it. Yeah. you know, I have a basic understanding of kind of...
And just as a note, we have a minute left, so...
Okay. maybe I won't go into that, but what I will say is going onto YouTube and looking up key terms, like what is a Diffie-Hellman key exchange? What is hashing? What is elliptical curve cryptography? You know, what is a smart contract? Just, I think if you go and Google those things as you know, for anyone, not just women, you're going to have a much better understanding, and you'll see it's not, yeah.
That is, so I'm sorry to say that is all we have time for, and I wish we could talk more because this is so fascinating. I want to thank my guests, Nellie Bowles, reporter covering tech and internet culture for the New York Times, Carrie Flynn, reports on business of technology for Mashable, Veronica Reynolds, co-founder of the UCLA Blockchain Lab. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Science Friday. I'm Flora Lichtman, sitting in for Ira Flatow. The bird-like dinosaur Archaeopteryx was first discovered in the 1860s, and this raven-sized dino, cloaked in feathers, helped kick off the debate about the evolutionary links between reptiles and birds. And then these days, you often hear birds referred to as living dinosaurs. Like, you've probably seen that baby blue heron picture. We will tweet it. But Archaeopteryx itself, the dinosaur that started it all, remains a bit of a mystery. Did it actually fly? Could it get off the ground? Did it glide down from trees like a flying squirrel? In new research published this week, a team of scientists turned to the fossilized wing bones for clues. They used a synchrotron, a particle accelerator, to peer inside of those bones and look for structures that might hold clues. Here to tell us what he found is Dennis Vooten, a paleontologist and research fellow at the European Synchrotron Radiation Facility. He joins us via Skype. Welcome, Dennis.
Hi, thank you very much for the invitation to join.
Thank you for coming on. So what did you see when you looked at these bones with a particle accelerator?
We visualized the mid part of the bone, specifically the humerus, which is the upper arm bone and a bone in the lower arm. And the first moment we saw it, we immediately noticed that the bones were extremely thin-walled. They look a lot like modern bird bones. And secondly, we immediately also saw that the bones were quite richly vascularized, which is consistent with a more active metabolism than was supposed by some avascular bone that was described 10 years ago from Archaeopteryx.
So does that mean they can fly?
I would feel comfortable saying that we found these adaptations to be very consistent with flight.
And, like a true scientist.
Yes, we tested it against a lot of other archosaurs, which is the group that includes dinosaurs, pterosaurs, and crocodiles. And within that group, Archaeopteryx exclusively allies with those animals that fly. So in that regard, yes, we feel comfortable saying that it flew.
Okay, so what kind of flying? Are we talking like albatross or chicken?
Again, we looked at specific mid parts of the bone. So for flight, you obviously require a little bit more. But because we found an indication for flight, we actually think we find an indication for active flight. We try to reconcile it with the skeleton of Archaeopteryx, and it's notoriously incompatible with the flight of modern birds. So we try to sort of delimit the range of motion that was possible with what we now know about the shoulders of Archaeopteryx. And based on that, we propose for consideration a flight style that would superficially resemble a butterfly stroke.
Oh, so not actually like a chicken, more graceful.
I wouldn't call it graceful. We literally have no idea what it would exactly look like, except that it probably did not look like that of a bird flying, including the flight of a chicken.
So how long would they stay up in the air? You know, how long do your measurements suggest they could stay in the air?
That's a very difficult question to answer because it obviously involves a lot of other parameters that are not so well understood, like metabolism and muscle size and things like that. But because it allies with short flying birds and they fly between 100 meter, maybe a kilometer for European listeners, I would say it's probably not a lot more than that and probably even quite a bit less.
How does this dinosaur stack up with other flying dinosaurs? Would it be the first? Where does it fall in the timeline?
Yeah, that's a very good question, because Archaeopteryx is one of the earliest known sort of early dino birds. And we've been focusing on Archaeopteryx for over 150 years now. However, originally through this, Archaeopteryx was considered the first bird. But recent discoveries from China have greatly enriched our understanding of this phase and has shown that there's actually quite a broad variety of flying and potentially flying dinosaurs. So although Archaeopteryx is among the oldest and the oldest that we feel could have had active flight, there's probably a lot of other very exotic material waiting in the wings somewhere. So we're waiting for that to come out, and then we can answer your question even more accurately.
Well, I look forward to that, too. Thank you again. This is Dennis Vooten, a paleontologist and research fellow at the European Synchrotron Radiation Facility, and he joined us by Skype. And if you have any follow-up questions for Dennis, he's doing an Ask Me Anything on Reddit tomorrow. Check it out. Okay, now, close your eyes and picture a dinosaur. Any dinosaur. Do you have one in mind? Now think about where that mental image came from. Maybe it was a drawing you saw online, or a children's book, or a museum exhibit, or if you were alive before 1993, perhaps it was a certain blockbuster film about dinosaurs. Every one of those dinosaur images, though, had to be created from clues that dinosaurs left behind, like bones and footprints and fossils and, yes, feathers. And this means that we owe our understanding of dinosaurs just as much to artists as we do to scientists, because it's the artists who take scientific evidence and turn it into a picture. And those pictures of what dinosaurs looked like have changed dramatically in the last 20 years, which means that your vision of a dinosaur might need a refresh. Here to tell us more is Gabriel Ugueto. He's a paleo artist and science illustrator who lives in Miami, Florida. He's also the subject of our latest SciArts video. If you want to visualize the animals that he is talking about, go to our webpage, sciencefriday.com/dinoart. Welcome, Gabriel.
Hi.
And if we welcome your questions about dinosaurs as well. Do you have a dinosaur visual myth buster that you want busted? Give us a call. Our number is 844-724-8255. That's 844-SCI-TALK. Or tweet us at SciFry. Okay, Gabriel, I want to start with, I think, the classic dinosaur image, which is the Jurassic Park T-Rex. What is wrong with this picture?
Well, back when the original film came out, not much was wrong with it. But today, I mean, with what we know, you can say that a few things. Like, for example, T-Rex probably had prominent lips. And when I mean lips, like, most of the teeth would have been covered. It probably also has some sort of feather covering on top of its body.
Really? Where?
Probably like around on top of, like, on the dorsal part of the neck, and probably on the dorsal part of the body, per se, on the trunk.
I'm thinking of a long mohawk.
Probably. I mean, we don't know. There is no direct evidence for it, but relatives of Tyrannosaurus, early relatives of Tyrannosaurus, have been found to be completely covered in feathers from head to toe.
Wow.
So, you know, Tyrannosaurus was a bigger animal, and it would probably lived in a warmer climate, so it probably needed less covering. But it most than likely still probably had some sort of covering. I mean, think about elephants, for example. They look naked, but in reality, they have small hair, like a little bit of fuss on top of their bodies.
Yes. What are the other popular misconceptions about dinosaurs that stem from the way they're drawn or the way we see them in movies?
Well, especially in Jurassic Park, I think the biggest misconception is the raptors, like Velociraptor. The Velociraptor in the movie is much bigger than the original Velociraptor would have been, the actual Velociraptor would have been. And Velociraptor was really completely covered in feathers, and it had...
Well, how small was it?
Well, about the size of a turkey. However, there was a raptor species called Utahraptor, which was about the size of the one in the movie. But the problem is that one would also be covered completely in feathers, and it would probably look more like a giant turkey.
A very threatening turkey.
A very threatening turkey with very big claws and teeth.
You also, I hear, have a beef with dinosaur skinniness.
Yes. Well, I think for a long time, paleo art suffered from shrink wrapping everything, skin wrapping everything. Like, you know, there was no room for muscles or fat tissue. And if you look at animals alive today, you see how much, you know, most of the skeletal structure is hidden by the muscles and skin and fat. So you don't see much of the actual shape of the bone. So right now we're in the middle of like a revolution in paleo art, because a lot of artists like myself are depicting dinosaurs with a lot more natural look, like including room for fatty tissue, muscle, and probably thinking of different types of integument, like, you know, feathers or scales in different parts of their body.
Well, speaking of feathers, why do people object to the feathers?
Honestly, I don't know. I mean, I think there is a lot of people have this image of dinosaurs as monsters in movies. So I think when you reconstruct them with feathers, some people may think that they look less scary, but I actually don't think that's the case. I think that, like we were saying before, if you find a raptor that was covered in feathers but, you know, was still very much a raptor with, although I don't really like to use that term raptor, but very much a velociraptor. Let's
Why
say.
Don't you like the term raptor?
Well, because raptor is used in biology to refer to birds of prey originally. The movie called Dromaeosaurs, which is what raptors, they call them raptors in the movie, but that's not the actual name. The actual name should be Dromaeosaurs.
Hmm. I want to go to the phones. Let's go to Tim in Oklahoma City. Hi, Tim.
How are you guys doing?
Great. What's your question?
My question was, what kind of, if any, modern living animals do you take measurements from to reconstruct the look of dinosaurs? I'm thinking along the lines of like John Gerchy does, measuring modern humans and chimpanzees to help reconstruct tissue mass and for early hominids.
Yes, I think that's very important. I think looking at today's dinosaurs, which is modern birds, and their relatives like crocodiles, is very, very important to understand how their muscles and how the other integument would be in dinosaurs. Like I spend a lot of time in the zoo looking at birds and crocodiles, and to understand how they look and how they look at life themselves, you know, to understand how they behave. Because more than likely, dinosaurs would have behaved in a similar way.
I'm Flora Lichtman, and this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Gabriel, how do you decide what colors to use?
Well, I take into consideration several things. First of all, nowadays there's a lot of super amazing discoveries in many fossils that have preserved impressions of feathers or scales. Paleontologists have discovered that melanosomes, which is a structure that is responsible for color in animals, fossilize. So we can now tell more or less the coloration of some dinosaur species. Like, for example, the Archaeopteryx is known to have been primarily black. So if we have skin impressions, which is very rare, we can probably say a little bit about the coloration, the actual coloration. Otherwise, I look a lot of what the climate was where the animal lived, what type of habitat it lived in, and what are the suggested habits that the animal had to make an educated guess of what it could have been colored.
Do dinosaur feathers look the same as bird feathers?
Some. I mean, dinosaurs have a wide range of feathers, of feather types. There were some that were like looked more like hair. They were monofilamentous, and there were other that were pinaceous, like today's birds. For example, to give you an example, a velociraptor or some other dromaeosaurids had something that looked more like fuzz on their bodies, but their wings, their hands, had pinaceous feathers like today's birds.
Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Robin in Orlando, Florida. Hi, Robin.
Hi, how are you today?
Great.
So I am a sixth grade teacher, and I have a student who loves dinosaurs and loves drawing birds, and he's actually really, really good at it. And I was wondering what resources I could point him to maybe look into a career in paleo art.
Well, I think the most important part is the art part of the career. I mean, you have to study illustration or graphic design, something that points you in that direction. Also, there are careers specialized in scientific illustration. And I would say one of the most important things is to be familiar with your subject. So you have to read a lot of scientific papers and get really involved in that community. Read a lot of the process for me to create an animal. I have to research a lot and read a lot of scientific papers. So it helps a lot to know a lot about the subject.
Thank you, Robin. Gabriel, have you always been a dinosaur geek?
Yes. since I remember, I mean, since I was a kid, and I grew up with the movies, and I was always interested in animals, but in particular dinosaurs, and that took me to my other love, which are reptiles.
What do you love about them?
They're just amazing animals. I think they're so, first of all, they look amazing. There's nothing that looks like them today. And they are so impressive, their size and the way they behave and how they dominated life on Earth for so long. They were so well adapted to the environment.
This might be like naming your favorite children, but do you have a favorite dinosaur?
No. it's very difficult, and it is like naming your favorite children. I guess, I don't know, I think I'm a little bit partial to theropods, which is this group of dinosaurs that are carnivorous, like includes like tyrannosaurs and velociraptors. But honestly, it's very difficult. I mean, I love them all.
In the 10 seconds we have left, can you tell me what to look for when I look at a drawing of a dinosaur so that I know it's a good one, like that it's lifelike and good?
A big telltale sign is if you can see the skull shape, the exact skull shape in the drawing of an animal that should be alive, then it's not a good drawing, because you're seeing something that just put it like a, it's not a good drawing.
That's a perfect place to leave it. Thank you, Gabriel.
All right. Thank you.
Gabriel,
thank you for having me.
Gabriel Ughetto is a paleo artist and science illustrator in Miami, Florida. And you can see our latest SciArts video of Gabriel's work on our website, sciencefriday.com/dinoart, courtesy of our video producer, Luke Groskin. Charles Berquist is our director. Our senior producer is Christopher Intagliata. And our producers are Alexa Lim, Christy Taylor, and Katie Heiler. And we had technical and engineering help today from Rich Kim, Sarah Fishman, and Jack Horowitz. We're active on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram all week, all social media. And if you have a smart speaker, ask it to play Science Friday wherever you want, whenever you want. You can email us, scifry@sciencefriday.com. Ira is back next week, and you can find me at Every Little Thing from Gimlet Media on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. In New York, I'm Flora Lichtman. This is Science Friday. I'm Flora Lichtman. Ira Flatow is away. This week at South by Southwest, Elon Musk said his BFR, his big rocket capable of reaching Mars, might be ready for testing early next year. Later in the hour, we'll imagine what a Martian civilization might be like with some space futurists. But first, we're talking about another technological revolution. It was a period when new ways of social networking were developing and innovation was totally changing how folks lived. And no, I'm not talking about Silicon Valley. I'm talking about the Middle Stone Age, around 280,000 years ago. This week, researchers report in the journal Science that our early human ancestors were making advanced tools far earlier than we thought. Forget about that clunky hand axe. We are talking about tiny, intricate spearheads. And these ancient humans may also have been trading with each other. This would push back the first evidence of trading by 100,000 years. So what do these findings tell us about how we became the complicated humans that we are today? Here to talk about that is my next guest. Allison Brooks is the author on these studies. She's also a professor of anthropology at George Washington University. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Allison, tell me about these tools.
Well, they are very carefully made. They required a lot of planning to make them because you had to prepare the block of stone to get off a flake that was just the right thinness and the right shape so that you could then make that flake into a point or a scraper or whatever you wanted to make it into.
Yeah, what did they look like?
The tools, the points are triangular. And sometimes the tip is so sharp that we think maybe it was designed to make holes rather than slice into animals. And they are made preferentially on a black stone that comes out of a volcano and cools. It's a volcanic material that cools so quickly it doesn't have time to form big crystals, and it is more like a glass. So if you've ever broken a glass, you know how sharp the bits are. And this is the sharpest material that we know of, actually, and sometimes gets used in surgery today because it's so sharp.
And how did this change our picture of the Middle Stone Age?
Well, the thing is that we knew that at 100,000, they were making points out of this material, and they were importing it from many directions and many sources. But this is 300 to 320,000, so it's much older than that. We had a publication last year that showed that obsidian was this black glass is called obsidian, that it was being imported from a distance in Central Kenya, that was even greater, but this is 100,000 years before our finding. So the fact that we have these small points, the fact that the bases are trimmed so that they can be easily inserted into a haft, and the fact that they're made of this material, which doesn't occur in the vicinity of the site where we found them, and the fact that we were able to trace the sources of the material in the site, in each level of the site, to a lot of different sources in the surrounding region. So they weren't just going to one source, they were going to a whole range of sources.
So in terms of the types of tools, can you give me an analogy for the kind of technology upgrade we're talking about when we're talking about going from hand axes to these kind of pointier, smaller tools?
Well, the technology, it's much smaller, much more specific. The hand axe was a big tool that was more like a Swiss Army knife that you could use in multiple ways, except it didn't have a lot of different blades, obviously. You could use the long side of it for cutting up animals. You could use the tip for gouging or picking at things. You could use the broad base of it for pounding things. And so it wasn't a very delicate tool. It couldn't do anything very specific, and you probably couldn't stab it into an animal. You might be able to throw it at something, but yeah.
This sounds like flip phone to iPhone to me.
Yeah. Well,
is that fair?
I would say it isn't even a flip phone. It's more like a princess phone or something from the Stone Age of telephones. But
so this obsidian, it wasn't nearby. It didn't exist nearby. Where did it come from?
Well, we have sources in the surrounding region. One of them is almost 100 kilometers, which is about 60 miles away. There are sources to the north. Most of them are, let's say, 20 to 30 miles away. But the important thing is that these are straight line distances. This is a landscape like some place in the western United States that's full of mountains and mesas and canyons, and you can't walk anywhere in a straight line. So in fact, these are minimum distances if you could actually fly. These were long treks for people that probably represent moving into places that were occupied by other people.
So the idea is that maybe these human ancestors traded these materials?
Well, I think the idea of trade, this is, I lived with foragers in the Kalahari Desert for many, many months over about 17 years. And the problem with foragers is that they experience down times when the environment doesn't provide enough food. There's been a flood. There's been a lack of rainfall. And what do? They can't put. They don't have a bank where they can put money. They don't have a silo full of grain. They don't have a barn with cows in it. They don't have any way to save for a rainy day except by building up obligations among their neighbors. So people who live in this sort of situation tend to create these relationships. The most valuable thing you might get on a trip like this isn't necessarily the obsidian. It might be the relationship with the people who live with the obsidian. And they consider it a value to meet you, because then if things go bad, you can't move your whole group into that particular person's territory, because very soon they wouldn't have anything to eat. But you can move yourself and your children and your wife and so on into that to go and stay with that person, because they'll have some food that you could that you could right. survive on. So it's a way of almost a way of saving for the future.
So does this one thing that struck me as I was reading these studies was, does this change our sense of the evolution of language? Like, how do you trade with other groups or exchange goods with other groups without language?
Well, the point is that we are, or the thing that I find interesting is, at the same time, we have some very early evidence of the use of pigment. And you think, how am I going to signal or show who I am before I can be close enough to actually take some of this obsidian? And we can imagine that people might be hostile to somebody just walking into their territory and taking some of their stone. So it's very interesting to me that we also have pigments in this time range. At two of the sites we excavated, one had brown pigments, one had bright red pigments. And the bright red in this brown, often dry landscape really shows up. You can see it very far away. Somebody coming with a red hat on or a red shirt, you really notice it.
But this seems like a huge change from how we have envisioned human evolution. I mean, I feel like we hear about these things happening much later, like 100,000 years ago, rather than 300,000 years ago.
We do, and I have thought for a long time that the roots of the things we see at 100,000 years ago were very ancient, and I've been trying to excavate sites in that time range that should shed light on exactly what was going on. So we were really quite amazed to find not only the points, but also all the obsidian that doesn't come from the local area. And I might mention that the pigments don't come from the site either.
Wow. So is this changing the narrative in a pretty significant way then?
I think that it goes along. I mean, we've been pushing it back for a while. I wrote a paper with a colleague about 18 years ago that said we should push the idea that that major aspects of our modern behavior, we should push that back to before 200,000, but this is now before 300,000.
Wow. Why are people resistant to that idea?
Well, what people are struggling with is, why did we then take over the world? And it looks as if the people who emerged out of Africa and took over the world may have taken it over, that the genetics are telling us that they took it over 50 or 60,000 years ago. So there's a search for some tremendous change that took place 50 or 60,000 years ago. But we would argue that what happened is actually that maybe there were several excursions out of Africa that didn't leave any descendants in us, which is, given how long ago it was, is certainly possible. And the one that was successful may be successful because they had used the basic elements of what we're now seeing at 320,000 years to develop even more complicated weaponry. or, sorry, even more complicated social relationships or something like that.
It's so fascinating. I can't wait to see what you find next. Allison Brooks is a professor of anthropology at George Washington University. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
After the break, we're going to Mars. Imagine how we live, imagining how we'd live and what we would do, and most importantly, to me, what we'd eat. Stay tuned. This is Science Friday, and I'm Flora Lichtman. Elon Musk made a surprise cameo at South by Southwest on Sunday, talking with screenwriter Jonathan Nolan, and one of the things they talked about was Elon's interplanetary ambitions. We got an update and a progress report on his big rocket nicknamed BFR.
We are building the first Mars or interplanetary ship right now, and I think we'll be able to do short flights, short sort of up and down flights, probably sometime in the first half of next year.
The first half of next year, Musk says we will be testing a rocket capable of flying to Mars. This got us thinking, what would a Martian town be like? Like, let's think about all that day-to-day stuff that we take for granted here on Earth. Fresh water coming out of the tap, abundant sunshine for growing food, that special flick of the wrist that you have perfected for flipping pancakes. How would all that change in a world with limited water and sunlight and much lower gravity? We called a couple experts to find out. Let me introduce them. Stan Love is a NASA astronaut and planetary scientist at NASA's Johnson Space Center in Houston, Texas. He's been up in the shuttle and on spacewalks, too. Welcome to Science Friday, Stan.
Thanks very much. My pleasure to be here.
Ariel Ekblad is founder and lead of the MIT Media Space Exploration Initiative in Cambridge, Massachusetts. She joins us via Skype. Welcome to SciFri.
Great to be on. Thanks for having me, Flora.
Okay, and if you have a question about life on the red planet, please give us a call. Our number is 844-724-8255. That's 844-SciTalk, or tweet us at SciFri. Stan, Elon Musk made a corny dad joke about opening a Mars bar during the South by Southwest panel, but in all seriousness, what would it be like to have a cocktail in low gravity?
Well, refreshing, I'm sure, especially since our current reduced gravity crew members don't get to taste any alcohol while they're on a mission.
People never drink on the ISS?
That's what I was told, and I didn't see any alcohol when I was there. And U.S. policy is we don't have alcohol on station. Other partner nations may have their own rules.
I'm thinking of those tiny airplane bottles. You could just sneak it into a spacesuit.
They might be tiny little airplane bags in this case.
Ariel, you run a group at MIT, the Space Exploration Initiatives, which isn't so much about building the rockets, but thinking about the tech we'll need when we get to Mars and how to create positive space culture. So what kind of innovations, what do we need to be thinking about to have a high quality of life on Mars?
Well, that's a great question, and that is something that the Space Exploration Initiative is thinking about at MIT Media Lab. We're looking at the technologies and the tools of engagement that will not just help humans survive once they get there, but also delight them, keep them engaged. Some of this is thinking about space food, and yes, even space cocktails, like you mentioned with Stan. And then some of it is technical, rigorous literature reviews about what are the current state-of-the-art technologies for, say, water reclamation, agriculture, future of architecture, what will we actually be living in when we are on the surface, that then inform some of the prototypes that we're actually building here in the lab on a day-to-day basis. One of the main goals of the initiative is not just to be designers, but we're designers, builders, and deployers, and actually trying to think about creating these technologies that previously had just been sci-fi, but now, if Elon is correct, and in, you know, just a number of a few years, we might be there, that we'll need to have those technologies ready to actually use on the surface.
I think we should get right to the very important issue of food. Stan, what would we eat on Mars?
Whatever we can get. At first, it's probably going to be stuff that we ship from Earth. We have no possibility of producing food on Mars right now. The closest analog we have to that would be the very small, brightly lit greenhouse room they have at the South Pole Station in Antarctica. For the long winter, there's no flights in and out, and all the food that the folks eat has to be either frozen, thermally stabilized, or occasionally you get a little bit of lettuce or a tomato out of that greenhouse and it's the highlight of your day.
Thermally stabilized does not sound delicious.
It is not delicious. And it's a very important, I'm glad you asked the question. It's something we should all be thinking about. If you read the journals of the Arctic explorers from around 1900, it is all about the food. On Mars, you know, you can't go outside without putting on a 300-pound spacesuit. The scenery is rarely going to change. The people are rarely going to change. You have to live in a sealed habitat. It can only be limited in size. And when your surroundings are that monotonous, food becomes immensely important.
So what could we expect? I mean, I have this picture from The Martian of, you know, vast fields being grown inside. Do I need to erase that image?
It'd be great if we could do it. But if you look at what we get with an acre of farmland on Earth without thinking about it, every square yard of that field receives about a kilowatt of light energy from the sun all day. That's a lot of grow lights, and it takes many acres to feed a colony. So we need the volume to put all those plants in. We need all the light to make the plants grow. And then, of course, every watt of artificial light, once it's been projected out, becomes a watt of artificial heat that you have to get rid of. And in space, getting rid of waste heat is really hard. If you imagine going
Why?
To your bathroom.
Yeah.
Well, go in your bathroom, turn on 8 hair dryers and leave them there for an hour or so, and then go back in your bathroom. That's what it's going to be like being in a room with grow lights on Mars. And on Earth, you can open a window and the heat goes outside, or turn on your air conditioner and pump that heat outside. In space, with Mars's thin atmosphere, it's cold, but it's thin. It's hard to put heat into that. It's going to be a challenge.
Oh, interesting. Ariel, are you thinking about this, food in space?
We are indeed, and Stan brings up a really great point about the light requirements and thinking about the power budget. For how much power and electricity do you really have available, and how much natural light or full spectrum artificial light could you bring to bear on an agricultural project, likely indoors, because of course we know that the perchlorates in Martian soil are going to make it very difficult to do any agriculture outdoors in addition to the limited atmosphere. Two specific technologies that we're looking at right now around space food. One is radiotropic fungi. So fungi that really can survive well in the presence of some radiation. And also, because they're low light, the ability to potentially grow some of these fungi as a dual-purpose crop. There's really innovative research coming out of Red House Studios from Chris Maurer's group. They're a group that just came to the Media Lab over the weekend for our Beyond the Cradle conference, which brought together about 60 leading thinkers, visionaries, and builders for the future of space exploration. The idea is to grow fungal mycelium, which are the roots of fungi, use those as binding material with some other organic matter. This can be a primitive for, say, something like a building brick for a colony for architecture, and then use the flowering part of the mushroom, the part that we would actually eat, to be an early example of grown on Mars space food. So that's thought number one, is
Does that
really
mean
relying
your stir-
heavily on mushrooms.
Like your stir fry would be growing Does out that- of your walls?
There you go. Yes, you just, you know, you're looking for that tasty mushroom to add to your stir fry, and you go plug it off the bricks that are enclosing you on the Martian habitat. Yes, we could envision such a future. I think realistically we'd be a little bit worried about containment, and so you're most likely going to see those fungi grown in something like a food computer, which actually brings me to the second example, which is fantastic work being done at the MIT Media Lab from the Open Agriculture Initiative, with whom we're collaborating for our space food research theme, looking at how can you have very energy efficient, small, contained, controlled environments, little food computers, where you could be able to start growing and thinking about not sustainable agriculture for an entire colony, but at least the start of agriculture for a few Martian astronauts.
We have a tweet from Flap. There's water on Mars, but is it safe to drink? Stan?
I'd want to filter and purify that first. We know, you mentioned the perchlorates in the soil. Water on Mars is all frozen or in the vapor form. Liquid water can only exist in certain low-lying areas on certain very warm days. So we're going to probably mine it out of the soil in the form of ice. You'll have to melt it, make sure that you get all the grit out of it. And then, yeah, with the chemistry going on in the Martian soil, you'd want to make sure you ran that through some filtration before you chugged it down.
Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Andrew in Houston, Texas. Hey, Andrew.
Hi.
Tell me your question.
I'm curious what would happen to our bone density in a lower gravity environment and what kind of exercise we might want to do to take care of ourselves on Mars.
Stan?
Oh, excellent question. So first of all, we have astronauts in a zero gravity environment on the space station all the time now and have them had them up there continuously since the year 2000. And without exercising 2.5 hours a day, and an hour or an hour and a half of that each day is on a resistive exercise machine that mimics weightlifting. Of course, you can lift a lot of weight in zero G and it doesn't really help your body much. The machine we have, you're fighting against air, compressed air in a cylinder. So it's the equivalent of weightlifting. And those folks are coming back with pretty good bone density. Of course, we know that just daily life on Earth keeps your bone density healthy. We have no idea whether Mars's gravity is enough to keep your bone density healthy because we don't have any data between 0 and 1 G. So that's one of the things we're going to learn when we go to Mars is whether you have to exercise that much extra to keep your bones healthy or whether the gravity there is enough to keep your bones healthy.
What's the gravity like on Mars?
It's 3/8 of Earth's gravity. So you'd weigh a little less than half of what you do on Earth. You'd bounce with every step. Your gait would be quite different than it is on Earth. You would take your steps more slowly, and you'd want to build high ceilings or people are going to bump their heads.
Ariel, have you thought about, there seems like there's some sports potential, new sports potential on Mars. Have you thought about this, sports or games?
Ooh, I love this idea of sports. I will admit that we have been thinking about zero-G games and some of them and how they might be applicable to a reduced gravity environment like Mars. This was actually another workshop just held at Beyond the Cradle over the weekend by one of our masterminds at the lab and the instructor of the sci-fi class, sci-fi fab class. The idea is to look at how astronauts can engage in really meaningful leisure time. So we know that mental health and equanimity is key, and being able to do just fun, energetic things is a great way to be able to keep astronauts healthy and engaged when they're either in orbit or potentially one of the first lone astronaut explorers on Mars. A lot of the unique things that we might think about for zero gravity, flying Tetris blocks, like what Chris Hadfield has done, Canadian astronaut with Velcro on Scrabble pieces to be able to bring up his favorite pastime, are things that we could consider on Mars if you're thinking not so much of a floating, you know, zero gravity chamber, but more of just the distances that you could bound, like Stan said. The ability to do maybe a little bit more acrobatic activity.
If you want to get in on this conversation, ask a question about life on Mars. Our phone number is 844-724-8255, 844-SCI-TALK. What about Mars apparel? It seems like it would have to be bulky.
If you're going outside, absolutely. If you saw the movie The Martian, our hero was going out in a fairly lightweight suit, and that may be a little bit optimistic, at least with current technology. Mars's atmosphere, as far as your body concerned, is a vacuum. You are just as dead on Mars if you take your helmet off as you would be if you did it on the moon or out in deep space. It is not close to enough to support life or even get one breath in before you lose consciousness. So it's going to look like a full-blown spacesuit, the big white suit that our station astronauts use to conduct spacewalks, except it's going to need a lot more mobility in the hips. To do a spacewalk, you basically never use your legs. Walking around on a planet, especially with 3/8 G, which if your suit weighs 350 pounds, is still a pretty heavy suit, you're going to need hip mobility and the ability to bend your knees and bend your ankles, which our current spacesuit doesn't have, but our Apollo moon suits had to a limited extent. So it's going to be a big, heavy, bulky spacesuit until we can do something about Mars's atmosphere to make it better.
I'm Flora Lichtman, and this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. In the book Dune, the desert dwellers on that dry, sandy planet, Arrakis, wear so-called still suits. They capture sweat and breath and everything and turn it back into drinking water. Is that going to be something we need to develop?
I don't think so. First of all, most of your time you're going to be in a habitat. Water will be precious. You'll either have to mine it out of the soil, hopefully not bring it from Earth because that's going to be even harder. And so we'll want to recapture all the water that we can. But the water that you sweat when you exercise, on Arrakis it goes out in the atmosphere and it's very hard to claw it back. In a sealed habitat, it's going to end up in your humidity removal system, which you have to have, otherwise it's going to be unbearably muggy in the place all the time. So we can reclaim it that way. the water that you exhale with each breath. You would want to capture that on a desert planet, but on Mars, again, it's going into the cabin atmosphere, and we'll pick it up in the dehumidifier.
We have a tweet from Damien. How hard would it be to sunbathe on Mars? And could you? Ariel?
Very interesting question from Damien about the potential impact of the sun's rays. So we know that at that distance, Mars is much further out than the Earth. The sun's rays will be weaker than what we would typically experience on Earth. And yet I would still not recommend it. I think it's an issue of a radiation dosage. And when you're on the surface of Mars, you're dealing with Mars's significant lack of an atmosphere that's comparable to what Earthlings are used to experience. So no, I would not recommend a sunbathing experience on Mars in the near future. To riff on Stan's comment about the sweat and the suits, we do have a couple of researchers here looking at innovative textiles that can capture sweat along the lines and seams of an internal suit. So this is less for, say, those bulky EVA suits, the external vehicular activity suits, and more for something you might wear on the inside. Yes, Stan is absolutely right that the humidity in a capture system, say in something like a HAB module on a Martian colony, would be able to capture most of the moisture, not just that you're losing from your body, but that you're also perspiring through your breath and your respiration. But we're interested still in having a unique new textile fabric for these suits for hygiene, actually. When you think about hygiene on a Martian colony, it's something that's not going to come as easily as it would even in the International Space Station, just due to resource constraints. And so being able to correctly and efficiently wick sweat and the minerals that are also exuded in sweat away from your body might be a really helpful thing for hygiene.
Are you talking about a self-showering clothes?
That is a great tagline. I shall suggest that in the future. Something along those lines, yes. And I think a source of really fantastic inspiration for us for that project is the biosuit coming out of David Newman's manned vehicle laboratory at MIT Aero Astro. And looking at a close form bodysuit, it's form fitting. It looks also very fashionable, very space forward thinking, and has these fantastic seam lines that are isopressure lines. So if you can combine the flexibility that comes with a suit dynamically designed for you to be moving freely with something like a self-cleaning, self-showering functionality, that's something that we're really excited and are looking into.
Stay with us, everybody. We're going to be talking lots more about life on Mars. And after the break, we'll also talk about an old idea that's being reinvented for travel across the red planet, the airship. There's one big difference, though, from the ones here on Earth. Stay with us. This is Science Friday, and I'm Flora Lichtman, sitting in for Ira Flatow. We're talking about what life might be like in space or on the surface of Mars with my guests. Stan Love is a NASA astronaut and planetary scientist at NASA's Johnson Space Center. Ariel Ekblad is founder and lead of the MIT Space Exploration Initiative. And if you've seen The Martian, you know that getting from point A to point B can be quite an ordeal on Mars. It is slow, dangerous, you have to ration your battery power and avoid all of those sharp rocks that seem to just want to puncture your wheels. So I'd like to bring on another guest now to talk about transportation. He's done some thinking about other ways we might get around the red planet. John Paul Clark is a professor of aerospace and industrial and systems engineering at Georgia Tech in Atlanta. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, happy to be here.
John Paul, tell me about this Martian blimp idea.
Well, a couple of us at Georgia Tech were thinking about whether a vacuum airship was viable. And basically, for those who don't know, a vacuum airship is same principle as a balloon or a dirigible, but instead of filling the inside with a lower density, lighter gas, you basically have an inside purely evacuated. So you're using the same principle, you're displacing a gas or atmosphere, but you, instead of filling it with a lighter gas, you're filling it with nothing. The big challenge, of course, is that that structure has to resist all the compression that you would naturally want to occur. And so we've done a fair bunch of analysis, and we found that with the materials that we have now, and luckily for us, the atmosphere in Mars is just like perfect amongst all the planets in our solar system. For actually deploying a vacuum airship.
So what is the structure that actually prevents this pressure from the Mars atmosphere from popping that balloon?
Yeah, well, it turns out that it's kind of like a sphere, but it's really an octahedron, basically eight-sided figure. And what happens is that we actually build a truss, and then we have a very thin, basically, membrane layer outside of that truss. So if you look at it, it kind of looks like a slightly deflated soccer ball or something like that, in terms of the flat sides.
I'm thinking of like a geodesic dome.
Yes, exactly. So it's sort of like that. And the key thing, though, is that those geodesic domes usually have all the structure on the outside. This one actually has a truss work inside. And the key thing for our truss work is that they're made up of what we call tensegrity beams, which are very light. And basically, you have the actual beams themselves in compression, and they have wires in tension. So they have some really cool properties. And one of them is that they don't buckle, even though they're very thin.
What would you use this for? What kind of transportation? Is it for long distances? Is it more of the Amtrak of Mars? Is it, like the subway? What's it for?
You can use it for pretty much any of those purposes. We've actually sketched out concepts for doing surveillance and scientific research, for moving entire habitats. If you build a big enough one, like you have a habitat you want to go explore another part of the planet, or if you just basically want to get from point A to point B. The cool thing is just basically, you can never achieve a perfect vacuum. And so you just need to determine how close you get to perfect vacuum to determine the altitude you want to cruise at. And then you have to have some system for provided horizontal propulsion. The best thing of all is that, unlike a balloon or a dirigible where if you have a puncture, you basically have to refill it with gas. This time, if you have a puncture in the membrane, you just patch it and just re-evacuate it, and it's good to go.
Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Matt in Pittsburgh. Hi, Matt.
Hi, how are you?
Great. What's your question?
Yeah, I was just curious if there were any theories or an anticipated impact to genetics as, if a small population of human beings colonize Mars, what would subsequent generations look like? Would there be an effect to physicality? Has there been kind of any thought around that?
I was wondering about that too, if in low gravity humans would get stretched out and they would get taller.
Exactly.
Stan?
Oh, good question. My understanding is that predictive genetics has not been a successful field of study for our species. So nobody knows. I think the second order thought would be if there were tigers that ate people who didn't get stretched out, then people would get taller. But we're probably not going to take tigers with us. So it's tough to know how genetic drift would result in a change in the population without some sort of selective pressure to go with it.
Ariel, have you looked at this?
I think I'll echo Stan's answer here in that we're thinking about it, and yet the right answer is that the data's not in yet. It's very tempting to speculate and say, maybe in the course of a generation, we wouldn't necessarily expect to see major genetic shifts, maybe a little bit of epigenetic shift, but could just the varying environment for a generation raised on Mars, say, lead them to be taller just because over the course of their singular lifetime, the force of gravity is not pulling down on their muscles and bones while they're in an early childhood development stage? And so then it's fun to speculate and think, well, does that mean if Martians took a tourist trip back to Earth, would they struggle under the weight of Earth gravity? These are all questions that we're asking, but until we do actually have some data coming in from a few Martian colonists, it'll be hard to know for sure. What I would point listeners to is Chris Mason's work at Cornell. Chris was just here over the weekend talking about the genetics behind the NASA twin study and some of the DNA changes that we are seeing between Scott Kelly and Mark Kelly for their differing times in space.
How many humans do you need to actually create a self-sustaining population, like a healthy gene pool? Stan?
Well, I've taken a look at that recently, and I have seen numbers anywhere from 500 to 100,000. So that's a tough experiment to do, and I hope we don't guess low. but certainly in the thousands would be a safe guess. So we're talking about a decent-sized town.
Yeah, indeed. Let's go to the phones. We have Caden in Hawthorne, Florida. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, this is Caden. So,
and maybe turn down your radio if you don't mind.
Okay. So would Wi-Fi and, electronics work on Mars?
Would they be affected? Would they be better? Would they be worse?
Great question.
That is a fantastic question. A lot of the infrastructure that we rely on for things like Wi-Fi and electronics and GPS here on Earth are actually due to satellites that we have in orbit, so a large infrastructure that we have orbiting the Earth at any one time. We're just starting to plan for what that infrastructure might be like. And when I say we, not just the MIT Media Lab Space Exploration Initiative, but more broadly, the Jet Propulsion Lab at NASA, other groups like SpaceX, trying to think about what is that infrastructure around Mars in orbit that we would need to really support on-surface operations. Another class of support, in addition to, say, GPS satellites or internet-producing, providing satellites, would be a staging base. And when Flora mentioned geodesic domes earlier in the context of Jean-Paul's work, that reminds me of the Tesserae project at the MIT Media Lab, a proposal for self-assembling space architecture that would essentially be flexible, reconfigurable modules for astronauts to live in orbit around Mars as they're preparing for missions to the surface and coming back. And maybe we can augment those type of tesserae self-assembling structures with technology and capability to give you Wi-Fi access, which is a great question.
Well, we could put some Wi-Fi transmitters on top of, on below my airships, actually. Put a bunch of them up, and we can create a little network.
That sounds great. we're solving the problems right here on the show.
And as far as the function of the basic electronics, those work pretty well on Mars. You know, every time we send a probe out into space, all of our communication satellites, the rovers on Mars, those are all chock full of electronics. They have to be designed to withstand a few extra radiation hits, which can flip bits in memories. But they work, in general, very reliably, and we wouldn't have a trouble with basic electronics on Mars.
We have a tweet from Christine, which says, did you have to mention pancakes at the carb-craving hour in the afternoon? Please tell me they would not be as fluffy on Mars. Or would they be fluffier? Discuss.
My vote is fluffier. The carbon dioxide gas in the pancake is going to expand. There's going to be less gravity making the pancake flat. I think you're going to end up with nice, fluffy pancakes.
I think that's the perfect place to leave this conversation. I want to thank you all for joining me today. Stan Love is a NASA astronaut and planetary scientist at NASA's Johnson Space Center in Houston, Texas. Ariel Ekblad is founder and lead of the MIT Media Lab Space Exploration Initiative in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And Jean-Paul Clark is a professor of aerospace and industrial and systems engineering at Georgia Tech in Atlanta. You might have met Steve. Steve is kind of a loner, yet extremely popular and very weird. Steve does not come out in winter. Steve is pinkish mauve and manifests as a streak in the sky. Steve is a phenomenon in the aurora, the northern lights, that citizen scientists and aurora enthusiasts have been looking at for the past couple of years. And Steve has attracted a lot of attention because it just doesn't look like the rest of the aurora. And it's often much further south than typical aurora colors. But new research, a collaboration between citizen observers and professional scientists, has an answer for what might be causing Steve. It's published in the journal Science Advances this week. I'll let my next guest explain what they learned and explain why Steve is named Steve. Liz McDonald is founder of the citizen science project Aurorasaurus and a space physicist at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center. Welcome back, Liz.
Hi, thank you.
Why is Steve named Steve?
So first, for those of you who don't know, the citizen scientists and amateur photographers were photographing the night sky. They saw this different thing. It used to be called a proton arc, but in talking to the scientists from NASA and the University of Calgary, we didn't think that was an appropriate name. So they said, okay, we'll give it a new name and keep taking observations. And so the name is inspired by the movie Over the Hedge, and it was named by Chris Ratzliff, who's the administrator of the Alberta Aurora Chasers, a Facebook group.
So Steve was named by the people, but sounds like you're sticking with it.
Yeah, so the paper shows a result where all the stars, actually the Steve and the ESA satellite swarm, aligned and really allowed us to understand more about the true meaning of Steve. And so what we found was that Steve is associated with a really strong flow of particles in the upper atmosphere. And that is associated with heating of the plasma, and also that somehow causes the glow of Steve, which is different. And so we're keeping the name. We actually, when we see it from satellites, we do know what it is. It's a sub-auroral ion drift. And that's something that has been studied for a long time, but never known to have this visible component. So that's what's new and really exciting. And the name, we've given it a backronym to be Strong Thermal Emission Velocity Enhancement, corresponding to what you see in the upper atmosphere, corresponding to what's causing Steve.
I'm Flora Lichtman, and this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Okay, so river of ions. What I'm trying to imagine what it is exactly. Can you just sort of break it down for me even further?
Yeah, it's a little hard to explain because the aurora is happening farther to the north, and then there's a gap, and then there's this narrow ribbon of light. And the aurora is driven by processes that happen hundreds of thousands of miles out in the near-Earth space environment, the magnetosphere. But at lower latitudes, Steve is corresponding to something happening still out in the magnetosphere, but closer in the inner magnetosphere. So that's where the subauroral ion drift is getting set up. And it's driven by the same phenomena that's driving and enhancing the aurora. But
so is this just particles from the sun? When you say subauroral drift, are we talking about charged particles from the sun that are hitting particles in the magnetosphere?
Yeah, so that's what normally drives the aurora, and those particles come in and they bounce off the upper atmosphere and release light. And in this case, it's actually a different mechanism in the upper atmosphere that we think is producing the light. It's that the drift is so strong that the plasma, the charged particles move and they heat up the neutral particles in the very upper level of our atmosphere. And so that's a different mechanism causing the light.
Why is Steve pinky purple?
That also we don't fully know. And it is related to that drift. We think that at these latitudes, the chemistry of the upper atmosphere is getting changed by this strong drift. And so you have some really exotic wavelengths of light being excited that are different than the wavelengths that are excited in the normal aurora because of the different process.
It's amazing to me that we didn't know Steve existed until now.
Yeah, this region is not very well studied, and so there are still some mysteries out there. And so it's really exciting that citizen scientists with their photographs have captured these new aspects. So mostly Steve is purple, but you also get a little bit of green light that pops up and moves around. And that is some really exotic plasma physics that we don't even understand yet.
Where can I see Steve?
So you can see Steve. It's been reported all over Alberta and most of Canada, also Scotland, Tasmania, I just found out today, New Zealand, and slightly less exotic places like Michigan and Montana.
Are there other Steves out there?
There could be some more mysteries in the night sky. Our citizen science project is happy to collect observations from people and work with people for deeper understanding of what they may be. And really, by working together, it's not just one observation, it's several observations of Steve, and so we can better characterize these new characteristics.
And where should people go if they want to get involved with Aurorasaurus?
It's aurorasaurus, like a dinosaur, .org.
That's great. Thank you so much, Liz McDonald, founder of Aurorasaurus and a space physicist at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you.
BJ Lederman composed our theme music, and if you missed any part of this program or you'd like to hear it again, subscribe to our podcasts. And if you have a smart speaker, ask it to play Science Friday whenever you want. Now, every day is Science Friday. Say hi to us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or email us, scifry@sciencefriday.com. Send feedback. Tell us what you'd like to to hear us cover. Ira will be back next week. And next week, I'll be back at my main gig. I host a podcast called Every Little Thing from Gimlet Media, and it's in all the places that you get your podcasts. In New York, I'm Flora Lichtman.